Hey, listeners. Thanks for dropping in. I'm Christy.
And I'm Melissa. And this is Buried Motives, where we dig deep into the details of some of the most gruesome
dirtbag murderers.
Hey, listeners.
Welcome back to Buried Motives.
We're glad you're joining us this week. Christy doesn't know what to say next, but she's got something to say about a case, so she can just go straight into that.
I was going to say, we really are, but we always seem to say that. But it's because we really are. We're really glad that you've joined us this week.
And we really are, or at least I am, excited to hear your case.
Well, I'm excited to tell you about it because I chose it because of you.
Really?
Yes.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Everything about you is a good thing, baby.
Did you write it so that I can keep guessing?
No.
Oh.
But the reason I chose it was because 3 weeks ago, you told us a heartbreaking case involving the game of football and how deadly an obsession over the game can get. That episode was on Lance Butterfield. If you haven't listened to it yet, what are you waiting for? Go back and listen right after this. I'm actually just teasing because I know most of you have probably already listened to it. But that case on Lance Butterfield got me thinking, what goes hand in hand with football players like peanut butter and jelly?
Cheerleaders.
Yes, cheerleaders. When Melissa told Lance's story, it stuck with me for a while. So when I stumbled upon this case involving cheerleaders, I knew I had to share it. This case involves teenage girls and the drive to fit in and be seen as part of the in crowd. How far would you go to protect your image? And does everyone have a green-eyed monster deep down inside that could prompt us to do truly horrific things?
Are we talking about Mean Girls today?
Kind of.
Interesting.
It does give Mean Girls vibe, but I wouldn't say that there was a clear mean girl.
Okay.
Even though this case is about teenage female cheerleaders, I do want to remind everyone that jealousy or status-driven murders does not only apply in situations like this. It could happen in any setting. To start, let's talk about our victim. Kirsten Marina Costas was born on July 23, 1968, in Oakland, California. She would be murdered on June 23, 1984, exactly 1 month before her sweet 16th birthday. Kirsten's parents, Arthur, or Art, and Barrett Costas, did very well for themselves and could afford to give their two children, Kirsten and her younger brother Peter, a good life. The family moved to Orinda, California, a small city just 30 minutes from downtown San Francisco. Arthur and Barrett moved there from Oakland because it was essentially a crime-free neighborhood and so logically a good place to raise a family.
Like they actually looked up the crime rate and that's how they chose the city?
Well, I don't know if they looked up the crime rate, but they knew that it was a good, safe community.
Okay.
Maybe the realtor told them. Who knows?
That's what I look up for VRBOs.
Do you?
Yes.
I don't even think that. I'm just like, yeah, let's go. This place looks nice.
No way. You have to Google map it and get your whole Google Earth thing going down so that you can see around it. And then you check the crime rate in the area.
That's probably smart because there was one time that my husband and I stayed at a hotel and our car got broken into in the parking lot.
That happens all the time. Mm-hmm.
But not in Orinda. Orinda was what you could describe as an affluent area to live in. According to the 1990 census, 6 years after the murder, less than 17,000 people lived there, and the average family income was just under $262 US per year and over $352 US Canadian dollars, if we put it in today's terms.
So they were pretty affluential then.
It was. But I do want to note that the murder took place in 1984, so these numbers would definitely have been lower than this, but it just gives you an idea. I could not find a census for 1984, just one for every 10 years. So not too shabby.
Literally.
Yeah. At the time of her murder, Kirsten was a student at Miramonte High School. Miramonte High ranked in the top schools in California for highest marks on state achievement exams. And it was said that the most common car driven by students there was a BMW.
It's an awesome area.
I want to go live there now.
That is not what we were driving to high school in.
No, we were driving the little old beaters. Actually, I remember driving to school after lunch with a group of my girlfriends, and I think we were in my girlfriend's car, but something literally fell off of her car while we were driving. So we stopped on the side road and we ran out. We picked up whatever the piece was, threw it in her trunk, and then carried on going to school. I don't even remember what it was, but that's what my school was like. It wasn't shiny new BMWs everywhere.
It was zip-tie bumpers.
That's right. The Costas family fit into this neighborhood well. They were beautiful, active, and wealthy. Arthur was an executive for the 3M Corporation. His income allowed Barrett to be home with their two children. As the kids grew, the entire family loved to spend time at the Meadow Swim and Tennis Club. Kirsten was a go-getter. She was on the varsity swim team and was part of the school's cheerleading squad. Kirsten was said to be super excited to have recently made the cheer squad. She would spend hours and hours practicing. In Orinda, and I assume likely in other areas of the U.S., cheerleading is a serious sport. Kirsten had to write an essay before trying out for the squad explaining what she could add to the school. Parents had to be prepared to pay for the fancy green and white uniforms as well as pricey training camps. Applicants would try out, and the girls who made it would be announced like it was an award ceremony. Their names were taken out of envelopes to be read, and the winning girls received flowers.
Wow.
It was a big deal. When Kirsten's name was read out, one of the 20 judges said she was a quote-unquote perfect cheerleader. And I thought that was interesting, too, that there was 20 judges for these tryouts.
Intense.
It is. Canada's behind this trend of cheerleading being a major sport across all of our schools. Most of our schools, I don't even think have them.
Yeah, I don't think so. At least not around where we're from.
Yeah. Kirsten was a beautiful girl inside and out. She had brown hair with golden highlights and an olive skin tone. She was described as cute and an all-American girl. She looked like the girl next door. By the time Kirsten entered high school, she was easily part of the it crowd. Other students called it the loud crowd because wherever the group went, people noticed. And we all know that popular crowd that is just noisy, loud, they're confident, and everyone seems to notice when they walk in. One of Kirsten's classmates later said about her, quote, "We used to say Kirsten had everything." Another friend said, quote, "I remember watching her after she made cheerleader. Everyone wanted to be like her." I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but I am sure we can all recall being a teenager and looking at someone else thinking they had it all. Talent, looks, money, and friends galore. It can seem like someone else is always getting to live the charmed life that we long for. But honestly, good for Kirsten. She was making the most out of the leg up in life that she had been given.
It does sound like she had a perfect life.
She had a pretty good life. She had a good childhood. Things were going well for her. Shortly before her murder, Kirsten received an invitation to join an elite group at the school called the Bobolinks, or Bobbies or Bobettes for short. This was kind of like a sorority for the most popular girls in the school. It was set up as a volunteer group to fundraise for organizations. The girls would have fundraising parties, bake sales, and blind auctions as part of their group. This totally gave me, on Wednesdays we wear pink kind of vibes, except Kirsten was no Regina George. That was a Mean Girls reference if anyone didn't get it.
That's perfect, though, because I already talked about Mean Girls. See, I am on track.
You are. Kirsten's mother described her by saying, quote, "Kirsten was the energy of the house. She was always listening to music, making phone calls, dancing. She was full of life. We are simple people. She was raring to go, ready to start to live her life when it was snuffed out."
That is so sad.
It's devastating. My heart really goes out to their family. On Thursday, June 21st, 1984, 2 days before the murder, Barrett Costas, Kirsten's mom, received a phone call at the family home. The caller was a teenage girl, calling from a payphone, asking to speak with Kirsten. Kirsten was away for a few days at a camp for cheerleading at St. Mary's College in Moraga, a piece of information that the caller already knew. The caller told Barrett that she knew Kirsten was away at cheer camp, but asked her to relay a message to her daughter when she returned. This caller said that the Bobbies were going to be holding a special dinner in honor of the newly initiated Bobbies that coming Saturday. The caller would not give Mrs. Costas her name. She said it was a secret within the Bobbies. She asked Mrs. Costa to please tell Kirsten to just be ready by 6 o'clock p.m. and they would come and pick her up from her house.
Like a setup.
It is. Kirsten's mother relayed the message to her daughter, and on the evening of Saturday, June 23rd, a car pulled up, as promised, to pick her up to celebrate. The driver of the car honked the horn, and Kirsten ran out. She must have been excited because she left the TV on when she left the house. The Bobby was late by a couple of hours. She arrived at their home on Orchard Road closer to 8:30 p.m. Kirsten was the only one home at the time of her pickup. Her parents had gone out with her younger brother Peter to a potluck dinner for his little league team. They had no idea that when they left for that team dinner, that would be the last time they would see their beloved daughter and sister alive.
That's sad, but they left her behind because she had these plans.
Exactly. About an hour later, there was a banging at the door of the Costas' neighbor's house. The neighbor had the same name as Kirsten's father, Arthur, so I will refer to him by his last name, Hillman, to avoid any confusion. Hillman answered the urgent knocking at his door, and I am sure he was unprepared and later haunted by what he discovered when he did so. His family had heard frantic screams just prior to the knock. Standing before him was his young, teenage neighbor, whom he had known since she was a baby, Kirsten Costas. She was covered in a large amount of fresh blood. When Hillman answered the door, Kirsten exclaimed, "Help me," and then immediately collapsed in front of him. She knew her parents and brother were at the dinner, and that is why she went to her next-door neighbor for help. Hillman hung on to Kirsten by cradling her head in his lap. He yelled to his son to call 911 as he tried to help her. Hillman could clearly see that Kirsten had been stabbed and asked her who had done this to her. Unfortunately, Kirsten was too badly injured to say anything. She would be pronounced dead just an hour later.
That would be shocking, hey, to open your front door and just have somebody looking like that and then collapse on you.
Yeah.
Well, and somebody you knew.
Yeah, since she was a little girl. She's 15 now. He's known her for a long time. He's watched her grow up. It only took minutes for paramedics and police to arrive at the scene. Hillman noticed that a car had sped from the scene when he found Kirsten. Not long afterwards, he spotted the same car driving back to the scene and quickly alerted the police. A man named Alexander, or Alex Arnold, got out of the car. Alex told police that he saw what had happened. Despite what people at the scene might have originally thought about this man, circling back to where Kirsten was murdered, he was a witness, not a suspect.
Oh, so he just saw it happen, and you know how you keep driving and you haven't even registered what you've seen? So then he circled back?
Well, he actually was more involved than you would think.
Oh, okay.
Alex and his wife, Mary Jane, were sitting at home playing crib with friends when they received a knock at their door. He said when he opened the door, there was a teenage girl with curly brown hair standing there, clearly upset. The girl, who we know is Kirsten, told him that she had been at a nearby church with a friend and the friend had, quote unquote, gone weird. Mary Jane said that she could see another teenage girl lurking at the end of their yard. She said this girl had, quote, a roundish face and light brown hair. The Arnolds invited Kirsten into their home to call her parents so that they could come and get her. This is when she discovered that her parents were not yet home from the dinner from her brother's team. Not feeling comfortable with the situation, Alex offered to give Kirsten a ride home, and Kirsten must have obviously been feeling uneasy enough to accept his offer. Alex said that as he drove Kirsten to her house, he noticed that a mustard yellow Ford Pinto was following them. Kirsten had Alex stop at her neighbor's house. Her plan was to go there until her family returned home. Again, this speaks to how afraid she must have felt. Alex asked her if she was sure she would be okay, and she reassured him that she would be just fine. I thought, what a great guy to actually drive her home to make sure that she'd gotten there safely.
So he lets her off at the end of the lane or drives her up to the house?
To the house.
Okay.
Alex said that almost immediately after Kirsten got out of his car and started to walk up to her neighbor's door, the girl who was driving the yellow Pinto got out of her car and rushed up to Kirsten. Unfortunately, he didn't get a good look at her face.
This is as he's pulling away?
Yeah, so he's kind of pulled up a little ways past the house, it sounded like. Kirsten gets out. He's like, are you sure you're going to be okay? She's like, yeah, I'll be fine. I'm just going to my neighbor. He's right here.
Okay, so they're not in the driveway. They're at the road still.
On the road.
Okay.
Yeah. And she's literally right in front of the house.
Mm-hmm.
Alex later said, quote, I heard Kirsten scream and saw her go down. He could tell that she was being attacked. I think this would have been one of those moments where things happen so fast, kind of like what you were saying, that your brain can take a few moments to register what is actually happening. It wasn't like Kirsten was saying some creepy guy who would appear as more of a threat was after her. This was just another teenage girl from a wealthy neighborhood. Describing what he saw, Alex said, quote, "When the other girl's arm went up, there was a flash. I later realized she was stabbing Kirsten. She never stopped." The flash he was referring to was the 18-inch blade of a knife.
A big knife.
It is.
18 inches?
18 inches. We're going to talk more about the knife, don't worry.
Is it like a sword?
No, it was like a butcher's knife.
An 18-inch butcher knife?
Yes. So you can imagine the damage this is going to do.
It would go right through her.
Yeah, it's devastating. This dirtbag girl had stabbed Kirsten a total of 5 times with her massive knife before bolting for her car and taking off. Alex had a split decision to make and chose to chase after the mustard-colored Pinto in his car to try and catch the monster who had just viciously stabbed Kirsten. When he wasn't able to catch her, he returned to the scene of the crime to tell police what he knew. So totally a good Samaritan. As police and first responders were flooding the area, Kirsten's family returned home to lights and chaos. Kirsten was just being loaded into the ambulance, and they quickly followed her to the hospital.
But when they first showed up, it's at their neighbor's house, so they wouldn't even think it had anything to do with them. They would think that they were just bystanders watching something terrible happen at their neighbor's house.
Oh yeah, I cannot even imagine the commotion that it would have been. And then to get out and find out that this involved their daughter. Their lives would forever be changed from that moment forward. I just can't imagine living that nightmare. I think my brain would first go to thinking that there was some sort of accident, not that my daughter had been stabbed to death by a peer.
No, because it sounded like she was getting along with everybody.
Yeah, she was very popular. Police thought this would be an open and shut case, that they would have their dirtbag in custody by sunrise. But this was not what happened. It would take 6 months to figure out what really took place.
Even though they had an eyewitness say that this is what he saw?
Yes. He didn't get a good look at her face, though. The community had even raised over $50,000 in reward money if anyone could bring forth information to help solve the case, but to no avail. And I'll point out that this wasn't a small chunk of change. Today, that is almost 200,000 Canadian.
But did anybody come forward?
No.
So nobody knew anything?
Nobody had seen anything other than Alex at the time of the crime.
Or the money wasn't motivation enough to spill the beans?
No, nobody knew.
Okay.
Knowing that it was another teenager who had killed Kirsten, rumors started to fly around the school. Police began to interview as many youth as they could. 2 classmates seemed to stand out more than the rest. One was what you might have described as a punk rocker, and the other was into heavy metal. So they kind of stuck out from the rest of the people that went to the school.
And that immediately made them suspects?
Well, it just made them stand out. That's what we'll say.
Okay.
One of these girls was an ex-friend of Kirsten's named Nancy Kane. Despite her known animosity towards Kirsten, Nancy had attended her funeral. Police learned that Nancy and Kirsten had once been friends. But slowly, Nancy fell out of the group. I assume she just didn't make the cut. Kirsten was in, and Nancy was out. Rumors also stated that Kirsten had become mean towards Nancy and bullied her, but I'm not certain of the full story regarding their friendship and fallout. Students told police that everyone knew how much Nancy hated Kirsten. They explained how one time during class, Nancy had yelled at Kirsten to shut up or she would kill her. Nancy would deny ever saying this. Nancy started to dress differently than the popular girls. She dyed her hair, and she was an easy scapegoat. Nancy was interviewed by police 3 days after Kirsten's death. Not helping her case, Nancy first lied to the police about her alibi. She told police that she was at the movies. This was false. It turned out that Nancy was actually with her boyfriend at the time, but didn't want her mother to find out because she would be in trouble. Police wanted to administer a lie detector test to Nancy, as they had to many other students at the school, but Nancy's mother refused it. Once the kids at Miramonte High heard that Nancy was a potential suspect, all heck broke loose, and the claws came out. Nancy became the daily target of accusations and relentless bullying. She was viewed as guilty.
I can just see the high school being the perfect environment where rumors would fly and a murder suspect could hide so easily because you'd just start a little rumor and it would cast suspicion on somebody else.
Oh, totally. And you can see how in high school, one small little rumor could turn into something really big.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what happened. Things got so bad for Nancy that by the end of the summer, she had to transfer to a different school. When she didn't return in the fall, everyone believed that this confirmed her guilt. And I read that the other girl who didn't fit the stereotypical norm was also bullied to the point of changing schools as well over the situation.
It's just so mean.
It is. But with that high school mentality, I think those kids were just trying to cope the best way that they knew how as well. This was something horrific that had happened in their school.
Right. And it becomes a mob mentality.
It does. Not to justify one bit what they were doing that shouldn't have happened, but I can see how it would happen. 4 months into the investigation, in October, police requested that the FBI provide them with a profile of who could have done this to Kirsten. What wasn't surprising is that the profile stated that the perp would be a female around the same age as Kirsten and would have known her. What surprised the local police is when the profiler stated that this girl would not come across as being remorseful. Still, the police were coming up empty. This is when Kirsten's parents decided to take matters into their own hands and hire a private investigator. And thank goodness they did. This PI began going over all the details. He looked at all the case notes, the interview reports, and the results of many lie detector tests that were administered. One name stood out to the PI, a teenage girl named Bernadette Prati. Bernadette had already been interviewed by police and had passed a lie detector test. What didn't sit right with the investigator is that the police never checked out or confirmed this girl's alibi, and her family owned a mustard yellow Ford Pinto.
Oh, that would have been like a dead giveaway, no? For follow-up?
You would think so. This is the same type of car seen being driven by the dirtbag at the time of the crime. So why she wasn't looked into more? I don't know. It just said, oh, she passed the lie detector test. Next, basically.
You would think that would be like number one lead to follow up on. How many mustard yellow Ford Pintos are there?
Yeah, I don't think it was as common as all the BMWs driving around.
Seems like they dropped the ball.
They definitely did. The PI shared his concerns with the police, and on December 9th, 1984, they decided to bring Bernadette back in for a second interview. During this interview, police read out loud to Bernadette the profile from the FBI on who likely killed Kirsten. When they finished, they asked Bernadette who that profile reminded her of. She answered, quote, "It sounds like me." Bernadette was allowed to leave the station and said she wanted to think.
Okay.
So they let her leave. That night, she apparently was wanting to talk to her mom about what she had done, but her mother was busy. The next morning, Bernadette handed her mom a letter and told her that she had to wait 30 minutes before she read it. It was Monday morning, and so Bernadette went off to school after handing her mom the letter. Bernadette's mother set her alarm for 30 minutes and studied her Bible while she waited. What she would read after that 30-minute timer went off must have been light years away from anything she could have imagined while reading her Bible. The letter read, quote, "Dear Mom and Dad, I have been trying to tell you this all day, but I love you so much, it's too hard, so I'm taking the easy way out. The FBI man thinks I did it, and he is right. I've been able to live with it, but I can't ignore it. It's too much for me, and I can't be that deceiving. Please still love me. I can't live unless you love me. I've ruined my life and yours, and I don't know what to do, and I'm ashamed and scared. Bernadette. P.S. Please don't say how could you or why, because I don't understand this and I don't know why." Can you imagine being the mom? You just finish reading your Bible, you wait that 30 minutes, and then you open this up and read it.
She would have been utterly shocked to read that.
Absolutely.
But the profile said she wouldn't be remorseful, and it sounds like she is.
But she also says, "I've been able to live with it, but I can't ignore it." I think she's more remorseful about
getting caught.
Getting caught and disappointing her parents. What's going to happen?
Okay.
She could feel some remorse, but she's not the most remorseful dirtbag that we've ever come across. We'll just put it at that. We'll see what you think. So let's look into who exactly this Bernadette Prati is and what led up to her violently stabbing another girl to death. Bernadette was born on September 20th, 1967, to parents Elaine and Raymond Prati. At the time of the murder, Raymond was retired from his career as a public works officer, but continued to teach Christianity. The family were of Italian descent and were described as being devout Catholics. They were viewed as a good family. I could not find a speck of evidence to prove otherwise. They were loving, hardworking people. Elaine was a stay-at-home mother to the couple's six children. Bernadette was the baby of the family. I read in one account that they had all daughters, which I think how fun, but I couldn't confirm it. Despite living in Orinda, because Raymond was retired, their family did not have the same type of fluid money or pocket change as a lot of the other families in the area.
Hence the Pinto instead of the BMW.
Exactly. The kids were definitely not going to bed hungry. They just couldn't get the newest and latest every time they desired. It took a lot to keep up with the Joneses in this neighborhood. They were more the high end of middle class, surrounded by a lot of upper class families. Bernadette had a good life. It sounded like she was way more fortunate than a lot of children in North America say that they are. However, it seemed like it was never enough. She compared herself to others and focused on what she didn't have rather than what she did. Anyone who has done this knows that it is a robber of joy. Being the youngest of six children, Bernadette's parents were a little bit older than a lot of her friends' parents, and so she felt that they didn't understand her as much, and I would assume maybe didn't have the same energy as some of the younger parents in the area. Because it happens to the best of us.
I can see that.
Mm-hmm. Also, perhaps because they weren't as rich as some of the others, or maybe because of their ages, the Prati home was said to be in need of some repairs. Little things like peeling paint and such. Instead of being thankful to have a nice big house to live in, Bernadette focused on the flaws and how embarrassing it was to not have perfectly kept homes like she perceived everyone else to have. She had told a friend that she wanted a house that looked like her friends' places, with Laura Ashley walls and Vogue furniture.
It's so sad because comparison robs us of so much happiness.
It really does, and I think we're all guilty of it sometimes.
Not me. I don't want anything. We spent the day wish shopping.
Nothing wrong with that. That's what we would call window shopping. You're just looking because you know you can't buy it.
Yeah. It's just so sad because there's so many dirtbags that we cover that have so much less. And she has so much going for her.
Right. And so much potential. You can't be grateful and envious at the same time. Another area that Bernadette felt insecure in was her personal appearance. She was an attractive girl, in my opinion, but she struggled with body image, as many 15-year-old girls do. During the investigation, the perp was described as being chubby, but from what I could tell, she was not. She just wasn't a paperclip. Regardless, struggling with body image can be all-consuming no matter your age or gender, and sadly, Bernadette felt like she fell short when comparing herself to the girls in the in crowd.
And no matter your size.
Exactly.
It doesn't matter. Like, you can have body image issues, even if you are a paperclip.
Yes. I just meant they described her as chubby, but I don't even think that she was. I think it was just this, oh, you have to be a runway model to be beautiful. And that's not the case.
No.
She was a very nice looking girl. A friend later said that Bernadette once said to her about herself, quote, I have an inferiority complex. I'm ugly. No guys like me. I'm so deformed. Look at my body, my hair, my clothes are so blah.
Man, that sounded like me getting ready this morning.
We can all definitely feel that sometimes. Any guesses which particular girl that Bernadette started comparing herself to the most?
Yep, Kirsten.
Yes, Kirsten Costas. Bernadette started to almost idolize Kirsten. She felt like Kirsten was and had everything that she wanted in life. Kirsten was beautiful, rich, talented, and popular. Bernadette began pitting her insecurities up against Kirsten's achievements. Bernadette had tried out for the cheer squad, but was rejected. She watched as Kirsten was told she was a perfect cheerleader. She tried to become part of the yearbook staff, but was again turned away while Kirsten was welcomed. Bernadette did manage to get a job in the student office and was able to work alongside Kirsten and get to know her a little bit better. According to Bernadette, Kirsten would just ask her to do things for her, and Bernadette complied. She was desperate to be Kirsten's friend. She thought that if they became good friends, Kirsten would be her ticket into popularity.
She was just going to use her?
Pretty much. She just kind of became obsessive, and to her, Kirsten was like the most beautiful, the richest, the most popular, and so she figured this is my way to get in. But this is all that Bernadette was focusing on.
Isn't it so sad when we take somebody's best or when they've done really well and we compare it to our worst and then wonder why we're not measuring up?
Exactly. I was just saying this the other day. It's like If we're homesick, we're in our pajamas, we haven't brushed our hair or our teeth that day, and we go on Instagram and see someone else's picture that they've posted that they've spent 1 or 2 hours getting ready for that photo. And yet we will compare ourselves. That's not a fair fight.
No.
And even if they are way more beautiful, be happy for them. It doesn't matter.
Well, it doesn't diminish you in any way.
Exactly.
Yes. It's just so sad.
It is.
Jealousy is the green-eyed monster.
It really is. I agree. And that's where I mean it's not just reserved for teenage girls. This happens a lot everywhere. Because maybe it's not about looks, but maybe it's, oh, this guy has all the toys that I want, or this guy has the better job. Things like that can play in as well. Bernadette was invited to join the Bobolinks, or Bobbies, which was considered a position of elitism. She wasn't an outcast per se, and did run in similar circles as Kirsten. However, this did not quench her thirst to be on top. In her eyes, Kirsten was and had more. Everything seemed to come easily for Kirsten. Bernadette wanted to be and have the most, and became obsessive over it.
Do you think Bernadette would have ever been satisfied, even if she had gotten to the top?
I don't think so.
Doesn't sound like it.
Mm-mm. I think she just had this quench, and maybe even being the youngest out of, if there was 6 girls in the family, being the youngest, just always feeling like you need to find your spot.
Yeah, I can see that.
One experience that particularly stung for Bernadette was when their class went on a ski trip. All the popular kids had fancy and expensive new skis, boots, and outfits. Bernadette's were old ones, I'm guessing borrowed or hand-me-downs from her 5 older sisters. Allegedly, Kirsten made some type of comment about Bernadette's used old skis and boots being crummy, which mortified and embarrassed her. Despite this, Bernadette wasn't deterred. She was set on making Kirsten her friend to boost her social status. If anything, it just made her more determined. Bernadette figured that all she had to do was find a way to spend some one-on-one time with Kirsten to win her over and jumpstart her journey into popularity. Which brings us to the mysterious phone call made to Kirsten's mother by Bernadette 2 days before the murder. On the night of June 23, 1984, Bernadette told her parents that she needed to borrow the Pinto to go to a babysitting job. This was not a suspicious claim. Bernadette's father decided to drive her to the house where she had babysat in the past. Bernadette convinced her dad to leave her the car. She told him she would feel safer knowing it was at the house just in case. And so her father left her the keys and walked the short distance back to their house. The plan was that Bernadette would just drive the car back when she finished babysitting. She was only 15 at the time, but they lived close and it would be a quick drive home. He did not know that his daughter had no intention of babysitting that night and would drive off as soon as he was out of eyesight.
He's not expecting anything sinister.
Not at all. He's doing it to protect his daughter so she has a safe ride home.
Right. And so that he can go to bed early because he's old.
Yes. He is older. He's retired. It's true. Bernadette pulled up to Kirsten's house as planned and honked her horn. When Kirsten ran out, Bernadette could tell by the look on her face that she was disappointed to see that it was her. And just as a reminder, this is all being told to us by Bernadette's account. I can't say for sure if she was disappointed or not, but I do think she likely assumed that Bernadette was just her ride and she would soon be at the anticipated dinner. Again, they were not BFFs. Before long, Kirsten started to realize that they were not going to a fancy dinner. Kirsten was dressed up and Bernadette was wearing track pants and an old jacket, something you might wear to go babysitting. When questioned, Bernadette admitted that there wasn't a dinner for the new Bobbies. She told Kirsten that she lied so that they could sneak out and go to a party instead. Kirsten agreed and they drove to the town of Moraga, which was only about 10 minutes away. Instead of pulling up to a party, Bernadette pulled into the parking lot of a church. Bernadette says that the two sat in the parked car just to talk. She claimed that Kirsten offered her a joint, but that she refused it. People who knew Bernadette later said that Bernadette would have 100% accepted the offer of marijuana from Kirsten if she thought it would increase her social standing. So nobody believed this. I don't know what's true.
But you can already see that she's twisting the story to make her appear more innocent.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm about to say. Bernadette said that after she refused the drugs, Kirsten got angry and they started to argue. Did this really happen? I'm not so sure. I do think, like you just said, it was a story either way to make her look more innocent and tarnish Kirsten's reputation.
All sounding a little jaded.
Yes. Many people believe that instead, Kirsten refused to go to a party with Bernadette, and that is what caused the argument. Kirsten did not want to show up to a party where she hadn't been invited to firsthand. As the fight began to escalate, Kirsten yelled at Bernadette that she was being weird and got out of the car. This was when Kirsten went up to the home of Alex Arnold. I will note that some reports said that she knew the Arnolds, but I really don't think that's true. That would have been very coincidental that they were stopped right by his house. So I don't think they did. Bernadette watched and waited as Kirsten went inside Alex's home to call her parents. She was panicking. She followed them as he drove her to her neighbor's house, all the while growing in frustration and anger that her big attempt to befriend Kirsten and finally be part of the IT group had failed. She worried that Kirsten would say to everyone the next day at school how weird Bernadette was and out her for her ploy to win her over. It would be social destruction. When they stopped and Kirsten got out of Alex's car, Bernadette grabbed the 18-inch butcher's knife she had laying on the rear passenger seat.
So she had planned this all along.
Bernadette approached Kirsten and Kirsten yelled at her to get away from her. In a fit of rage and desperation, Bernadette plunged the gigantic knife into Kirsten's abdomen twice. Kirsten raised her hand to defend herself, causing Bernadette to stab her in the arm. Kirsten let out what was described as a blood-curdling scream and hollered out, help me, I've been stabbed. At this point, Kirsten fell to the ground, and Bernadette relentlessly drove her knife into Kirsten's back twice, stabbing her a total of 5 times. As quick as it happened, Bernadette ran back into her family's Pinto and took off. As I mentioned, Alex tried to chase her down but lost track of her. When he spoke to police, he described the attacker as a chunky teenage girl with stringy blonde hair in track pants. He admitted that at first he thought that the girls had just started fist fighting. He didn't know Kirsten was stabbed until he saw the blood. As Kirsten fought for her life, Bernadette arrived back home around 10 o'clock p.m. She said she was all but expecting the police to burst through her door and arrest her. She was certain that Kirsten would tell on her. She had no idea that by 11:02 p.m., Kirsten had been rushed to the hospital where she was pronounced dead. She said she found out the next day at school. The injuries that Kirsten had sustained were beyond brutal. She had 2 12-inch gashes on her back. These stabs punctured her right lung, went through her diaphragm, and lacerated her liver. One of the puncture wounds to her front was 15 inches in length. It penetrated her left arm, chest, and left lung. One of the stab wounds had bisected her heart's major artery. Meanwhile, Bernadette said that her and her mother went for a leisurely late-night stroll with their dog around the neighborhood that same evening. No one suspected her of anything. I don't know how she was able to contain herself and keep her composure. And I was thinking that I wonder if her mom sensed that something was off and suggested that they take a walk together.
Well, that would be an interesting idea. Do you think that she would be in shock by that time or that she had anticipated that she had killed Kirsten?
I don't know. I don't know how premeditated it actually was or if it was just that trigger, like this isn't going to work and she's going to tell everyone that I'm weird.
Why was the knife in the back seat?
Well, she tries to explain that, which we will get to.
Okay.
But that does come up a lot in the trial as well. Why was that knife there? I'm also not sure how her mother did not notice anything. Bernadette said that when she got home, she quickly hid the knife. The next day, she washed the knife and returned it to the kitchen. She took the clothes that she had been wearing, put them in a garbage bag, and threw them into the dumpster at the Sleepy Hollow Swim Club. So her family would have continued going on using that knife for 6 months.
That's gross.
Yeah. About the 6 months that passed after murdering her classmate, Bernadette said, quote, I was really good at blocking it out of my mind, and I still am. That's why I can live through every day, because it doesn't seem real. And I thought, how nice for you, Bernadette, that this isn't eating you up inside.
That's very cold.
Mm-hmm. Bernadette had sat through Kirsten's funeral and had even spent the summer taking classes to prepare for her first confirmation in her church. But the guilt never got to be too much for her.
Well, if she was disassociating, it wouldn't.
Right. One thing that maybe showed some remorse was what was later discovered in Bernadette's diary. A passage of it read, quote, I have caused a lot of hurt and pain to a lot of people. I don't want to hurt people anymore. I want to go to heaven when I die. I regret what I did. I can't bring Kirsten back or change time. If I kill myself, I will hurt even more, meaning her family. Plus, she believed that if she killed herself, she would go to hell. And I find this interesting. Was she not worried that killing someone else might send her there too?
Not if she felt justified in it. When did she write that?
Within that 6 months. So Bernadette kept quiet and life carried on as per usual for 6 entire months until Bernadette handed her mom that letter on a Monday morning. After reading the letter, Elaine, Bernadette's mother, rushed to the school. Bernadette was there waiting for her. Elaine called her husband Raymond and told him to meet them at the police station. And I do have to say, good on her parents for doing the right thing and not trying to help their daughter cover up her actions. Elaine has spoken about how hard this was. She said she picked up her daughter and took her to the station herself because she, quote, wanted a last chance with my daughter. I wanted not so much to talk to her, but to be with her. As you can imagine, when word got out, everyone was stunned that one of them had done such an abhorrent thing. Some people had gone as far to believe that Kirsten had to have been murdered by devil worshippers.
Because that would be the only explanation.
Right. It couldn't be someone in their crowd.
That would have been so hard for her parents.
I cannot imagine. How heartbreaking. Again, another victim of this. Sometimes people can look at the parents of the dirtbag as part of the problem, but they really weren't.
No. And I wonder if it was their faith that made it so they could do that. The responsible thing to do. This is in the long term. This will be the best thing for her.
Oh, likely. They knew they had to be honest about it.
Yeah.
But still gut-wrenching.
Mm-hmm. It didn't even seem like they hesitated.
No. As soon as she read it, she went to the school. Bernadette was waiting for her. She knew her mom would come. She called her husband, meet us at the station, and they went right there. But I bet she drove a little bit slower. Because she knew from that time on, their life was going to change too. Here's where we're going to talk about the knife. About the knife, she said her older sister kept the knife in the car to cut fruit and vegetables.
An 18-inch knife?
Yes. Yeah, right. Yep, that's exactly my thought. Her sister, though, would later testify in court that yes, it was her knife, and that yes, she did keep it in the car to cut produce during her work lunch breaks.
Okay, was she eating coconuts?
I don't know. This seems a little hogwashy to me. Not that she would keep a knife in the car to cut her food with. But who would choose a butcher's knife that is 1.5 feet long to do so?
She was cutting pineapple and coconuts.
Maybe. But even then, a 12-inch knife will do, not 18 inches. I will admit that I sometimes do have a knife in my purse or car to cut pieces of my apple off if I have brought one with me. It's the way that I eat apples. But I assure you that it is only ever a small paring knife and it has a cover for the blade. And as soon as I remember, I take that knife back into the house with me. Never would I dream of taking the biggest knife in my kitchen with me to casually cut up a cucumber on the run.
It does seem very bizarre.
But she testified in court that, yeah, it was my knife and that's why I keep it in there.
Okay.
So I don't know if she was telling the truth or if this is just
her trying to cover up for her sister.
Maybe.
Okay, maybe. I'm thinking if her parents are so honest and like take her right to the police station, don't you think those same values would be instilled in their other children, and so they would tell the truth?
You would think so.
But maybe that's a wrong assumption, because that's all it is an assumption.
It's true. So I don't know. She did testify, and I know I take a knife with me into the car often, because I don't like to bite into apples. But I like apples, so I cut them. I just cut off a piece and eat it as I'm going along.
I don't think I have ever carried a knife into the car. Maybe that's already in my lunch bag.
Sometimes my knife will be left in the car for a couple of days or left in my purse for a few days. But it's not 18 inches. It's a little paring knife. So hogwash, I don't know. Listeners, you decide. If her sister did leave that knife in the car, then it could speak to more it being just a split decision. Saw the knife. I have to save my reputation.
Okay.
The other questionable thing with Bernadette's story is that if she was really planning on taking Kirsten to some boy's party, like she said, why was she dressed so casually? Image was everything to Bernadette. It was highly unlikely that she would show up to a social event in track pants and an old jacket.
Clothes that she would be willing to throw away after.
Exactly what I put next. Or was it that she didn't want to ruin any of her nice clothes with her victim's blood?
Yeah, I did think that was sketchy. Who plans to go to a party in sweats?
Not this girl. Not when image is everything to her. On top of this, why was she so secretive? Why did she lie to her parents? And why did she use a payphone to call Kirsten's mother? Was it because she didn't want the call to be traced back to her? I would like to believe that this murder was a snap judgment, but these factors make me question if Bernadette had planned to end her biggest rival's life that night. Did jealousy literally turn her into a green-eyed monster?
Yes.
Yeah. That's what I'm leaning towards as well.
There's just too many things.
And if it was a snap judgment, you think she would be remorseful. Mm-hmm. Like, oh my gosh, what did I do? Originally, police did not check Bernadette's alibi because she had passed her lie detector test. Afterwards, they spoke with the family whom Bernadette claimed she was babysitting for, and they informed police that she hadn't babysat for them in well over a year. Had police followed up, 6 months might not have gone by before the truth came out. 6 months of Kirsten's family not searching for answers. What was clear at this point was that Bernadette had, in fact, killed Kirsten. What had to be decided was if it was premeditated. That being said, Bernadette's defense team managed to work out a deal where Bernadette would plead guilty to second-degree murder. Apparently, because she was a minor, her sentence would be the same if she was convicted of second-degree murder as it would be if she was convicted of first-degree murder. But it was just what would go on her record. The maximum sentence would be the same.
Right, because there's a maximum sentence for a juvenile.
Yes. Both sides of the law agreed that a plea would be the best-case scenario for everyone. Everyone except for Bernadette. She did not want to admit that any of her malice was premeditated in any way.
So she makes him go to trial?
She does.
What?
Yep.
Why would her parents not overrule that?
I don't know. Her trial would begin in March of 1985. She opted for a judge-only trial, no jury. So she knew what she was doing.
Or she had been advised very well.
Yes. That's probably more likely. During the trial, the idea that Bernadette was more than just infatuated with Kirsten came out. It was alluded to that perhaps she wanted more than a friendship, which added to her desperation to not let Kirsten tell anyone about her advancements after being rejected.
Was there evidence of that?
No, I don't think this was true. Just it had come out in the trial.
Just as a possibility.
Yeah, I think they were flinging mud.
Yeah.
Bernadette said that she made every attempt to be Kirsten's friend, and that she was certain that after Kirsten called her weird, her social life would be over, a fate that some would say is worse than death.
To a teenager, it can seem that way.
It can, but it isn't. But I do believe that Bernadette would have been feeling this way at the time of the stabbing. It would have been very real to her. Bernadette's 1.25-hour taped confession was played during the trial. She said, quote, "I was afraid she was going to tell people I was weird. I lost for cheerleader, and I didn't get the club I wanted, and I didn't get yearbook," meaning the committee. Bernadette continued to try and explain herself when she said, quote, "The things that got me mad was it hurt and I couldn't change, like looks or money or popularity or things." On the night of the killing, Bernadette said, quote, "I wasn't feeling good about myself," meaning her self-esteem. She said, quote, "It was like a dream. It was so much like a dream, I thought I was going to wake up." When asked why she did it, she said, quote, "I guess I was angry. I really don't know. She was telling me to go away. I just got angry and I did it." About killing Kirsten, Bernadette also said, quote, "I didn't know what I was doing. And then afterwards, I was so horrified. I didn't think about if she was going to die." I will add in here that she wasn't so horrified by her actions, that she didn't stop the bullying that Nancy was taking because of her actions. She was fine letting another girl get so bullied for something that she had done that she had to change schools. And I don't know what you think is going to happen when you stab somebody with an 18-inch long knife. Five times. Yeah. When asked why she took so long to come clean, Bernadette admitted that she was worried about what her classmates would think of her. She said, quote, "I bet about 500 people would like to shoot me right now." Honestly, if the PI didn't get involved, I think Bernadette would still be holding on to this secret. I think she only confessed because she had been questioned again by the police and she thought she was done for. Ironically, truth be told, police didn't have any real evidence connecting Bernadette to the crime and needed her to come clean. When giving her confession, it was clear that Bernadette thought she was going to get off for what she had done. She asked if she had to go back to the same school because she couldn't live with it if it became known what she did. She said she would rather die.
Was there a media ban on the trial? Like, doesn't everybody already know what she did?
No, I don't believe there was any ban.
So everybody already knows what she did.
Yeah, but she's like, do I have to go back to the same school? But she had seen them pick apart these other two girls. She knew what would be coming for her.
She's still more concerned about herself than what she did.
Yes, and she's thinking she's going to go back to school. Does this mean that she felt justified in her actions and didn't deserve punishment in her eyes? Perhaps because the picture she painted of Kirsten was that she was always putting her down and bullying her. So she's tarnishing the image of her victim. Ironically, after accusing their daughter of being a bully and a drug user, Bernadette apologized to Kirsten's family for what she had done. An officer testified during the trial that when they spoke with Bernadette during the investigation, quote, she was very cool. There was no sense of remorse. She seemed to think she was justified in doing what she did.
Sounds like it. And the first time that they interviewed her, she probably didn't set off any alarms because she didn't feel any remorse.
Right. And that's how she passed the lie detector test. Even though we know those don't have a whole bunch of merit, but she passed it no problem. Ultimately, Superior Court Judge Edward Merrill did not believe that Bernadette had meticulously planned to kill Kirsten from the beginning.
Really?
Yes. He convicted her of second-degree murder. I guess he believed the sister about cutting her tomatoes with an 18-inch knife.
Oh, I am shocked. Or do you think that it wasn't so much about what he believed, or he was just being lenient?
Well, I would hope it would be what he would believe, being a Superior Court judge. Bernadette's sentencing took place on April Fool's Day, April 1st, 1985. Apparently, Bernadette tried to plead guilty to a lesser charge, which frustrated the judge, who felt that a trial wasn't even needed in the first place, and they could have saved Contra Costa County tens of thousands of dollars just to find out what they already knew. He stated that the trial should serve a greater purpose than a form of entertainment. So at this point, he had had enough of her.
But he still only gave her second degree.
Yes. But then she's like, okay, wait, I'll plead guilty to a lesser charge. And he's like, are you kidding me? Step back, young girl. I believe the entertainment remark was because the courtroom was filled to the brim with teenage girls and their mothers during the trial. It was quite the spectacle.
But she wasn't on the cheerleading team.
But she was still a Bobby. And the victim was on the cheer squad.
Right.
Bernadette was handed the maximum sentence that she could be at that time for her age. And let me warn you, it isn't much. On that day of fools, she was given a maximum sentence of 9 years in a juvenile institution.
And that's what she would have gotten for first degree, too.
Yes, to the age of 25. Kirsten's father told reporters after the sentencing, quote, my feeling is that the law had been served. We've lost our daughter. I don't believe the punishment will ever match the crime.
It's true, it never could, but it does seem still really low.
It does, but it was the maximum that she could get. Kirsten's mother said, quote, Kirsten's hopes and ideals were shattered on June 23, 1984. She was attacked by Bernadette Prati and left in the street to die. She also said, quote, my heart is empty. I ache. I'm half a person. She probably will be given her freedom in a few years. I ask the people of California, is this justice? Bernadette was turned over to the California Youth Authority until she was a maximum of 25 years of age. Shockingly, Bernadette would be released even before turning 25. She was sent to what is now known as the California Division of Juvenile Justice Facility in Ventura. During her time there, she graduated from high school with a 4.0 GPA. She also was able to earn a college degree, things that Kirsten never got the opportunity to do.
Probably all at the expense of the state.
Oh, it was. Definitely. In 1991, Bernadette was denied parole because it was said that she hadn't yet learned to control her jealousy and rage. However, just the following year, on June 10th of 1992, at the age of 23, in a 2-to-1 decision, Bernadette was released from custody into the care of her parents. 2 years later, she was free and clear to live her life. She only served 7 years for taking her classmate's life. And for what? Killing Kirsten because she thought Kirsten was better than she was?
Just so sad and so pointless.
Yeah, 7 years. One parole board member stated that Bernadette was no longer an immediate threat to society. On the flip side, another stated that she absolutely remained a threat to society and said she still needed treatment to control her anger and impulses. Bernadette has continued to be blessed with the privilege to live her life as she pleases. She allegedly moved out of state, and it is highly believed that she changed her name to Jeanette Tomanka. She has a great career. She got to experience falling in love and getting married. She has been blessed with children and runs a blog. One rumor I read was that she was a nurse and medical writer, even publishing work in a scientific journal. It is also said that she has been living her life peacefully since her release and has been lucky to live into her 50s. If she isn't already, she will likely have the privilege of becoming a grandma one day.
That's so sad because all of those things were taken from Kirsten.
I know. She should have been experiencing those things right alongside Bernadette. Bernadette has a sister who is very well known in the business world, but I'm deciding not to include her name because I don't know how she feels about being connected to her little sister in this way.
She wasn't the one that kept the knife in the car?
I'm not sure. In 1986, Kirsten's parents moved to Hawaii and have rightfully expressed their opposition to the release of their daughter's killer. I read rumors that they have also lived in Alaska. I truly do hope that the Costas family is doing well and have found healing to whatever degree possible for them. When Bernadette had her last parole hearing, the couple sent in a video recording asking the parole board to please not release their daughter's killer. After she was released, the Costases said, quote, "From a victim's standpoint, the punishment doesn't even begin to equate the magnitude of the crime. You can't replace your child, so you think about that all the time. The emotions and the public safety, we lose on both accounts." This case inspired many media productions, including a movie starring Tori Spelling titled Death of a Cheerleader. I haven't watched it, but it sounds like it comes off more sympathetic towards Bernadette, which kind of rubbed more than a few people the wrong way. I will end with one more tidbit of information. When you Google Bernadette Prati, a wiki page does not come up for her. Instead, she is linked to a page in Kirsten's name, which to me feels like poetic justice.
That is pretty awesome.
And that is the story of a young girl who was so jealous of her classmate that she brutally stabbed her and left her for dead on a neighbor's front lawn. The self-serving murderer with no regard for anyone else's life. A girl willing to be popular at any cost. Bernadette Prati.
What a senseless death. She was really a green-eyed monster.
She really was. It's shocking how it just took over her life and she was willing to protect her reputation to the point of murdering somebody else.
Or her lack of reputation.
Yeah, because she didn't want to be called weird by one of the most popular girls in her class. Where any of us who have grown out of that, we know that that doesn't even matter. What happens in high school, in the grand scheme of things,
is so minuscule.
It is. And Kirsten was just living her best life.
Which is what we all should be able to do.
Yes. And listeners, we hope that you'll live your best life by joining us again next week when Melissa will have another case.
Until then.
See ya.
Bye.
It's Friday night while we're recording this. Melissa's just been fed. Now she's getting sleepy.
So true. Sorry, I'm still laughing at their name. What is it, the Bobbits? I've never seen it.
You've never seen Mean Girls?
Nope.
On Wednesdays, we wear pink?
No, I have not seen Mean Girls. Or on Wednesday, we wear pink.
No, that's the thing that they do in Mean Girls. Okay, you and I have to watch Mean Girls. It's a classic, Melissa.
Star Trek? Check.
No. I need to get you some Mean Girls stat.
I was raised with two brothers.
I had two brothers growing up.
Yeah, but you also had a sister.
A way younger sister. I had to lead the way. She wasn't getting me into that. I will be your sister, Melissa. I will introduce you to Mean Girls and Clueless and all of those staples. But you just snapped your fingers.
Yeah, that's okay, because you're not putting any of that in it.
Wait. I might.
This is how behind the times Melissa is.
Yeah, I need to work on this, girl.
Run buck naked across the hall. It's okay. More sugar? There's candy, Christy.
It's like, oh, I miss that feeling. I feel so alive.
Hey, we're live, pal, and we'd love for you to come check out our podcast, Tales from the Estate. Each week, we talk about our top five favorite somethings. My beautiful wife, Caitlin, likes to share all sorts of random facts.
Yeah. Did you know that cows have accents?
We did now. But we also review all sorts of snacks and other great things. And so if you love everything random, I think you'd enjoy Tales from the Estate. So come check us out.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
come on a journey like no other, where you will discover many rogues that will lead you to a happier, healthier, and more stress-free life. And the beauty is, you don't need any vacation time for this adventure. The journey will come to you. Join Avery Rich on your very own journey into yoga. Along the way, she will demystify yoga poses and guide you into a yoga posture or short sequence, all in less than 15 minutes. You have nothing to lose but stress. The Journey into Yoga podcast. It's not for people who like yoga. It's for people who don't like yoga. Follow or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or at AveryRich.com.
Another Sound Off Media Company podcast.